Cien Pereira Delgado. Mr. Clue.
Good morning. May it please the court. Some of the issues are half resolved in terms of the case. I wanted to talk about those quickly. The forfeiture issue, the government has agreed that the case should be remanded for resentencing regarding forfeiture. And we argue two reasons. The government has agreed as to one of the reasons. I don't know whether the court wants to hear any additional argument about the other reason why we believe the this court's precedent requires that forfeiture money judgment be determined under a substitute asset forfeiture theory, but that's the only legal issue that is not addressed. It doesn't really matter from our standpoint what ground the court uses to a remand for resentencing on forfeiture. With regard to the issue that the court sent out a supplemental letter, the this court recently held in United States versus Rodriguez that when a district court imposes in a judgment, written judgment, conditions of supervised release that it did not announce at sentencing, that rather than the relief that the appellant requests, which would be to simply correct the judgment to eliminate those conditions that were not announced at sentencing, which is the relief that we have requested in this case and which was requested in the Rodriguez case, that the remedy is to remand to the district court as part of a resentencing for the district court to determine specifically and announce specifically which conditions it wants to impose. In the Rodriguez case, again, time for filing certiorari is not passed on that, so I wouldn't say that that's necessarily a completely closed issue as to what the relief should be, whether the relief should be to excise the conditions not imposed or to remand for resentencing. Assuming in Rodriguez, the case was already remanded for sentencing, a mandate had issued, and Rodriguez was already resentenced. And the importance of what happened in Rodriguez is, I think, reflected in the resentencing in Rodriguez, where Judge Moreno imposed quite some very different conditions. First of all, he imposed a different length of supervised release after considering the effect of the particular conditions on the individual defendant's circumstance. And secondly, he removed one of the conditions, which was to limit the defendant's travel to the Southern District of Florida. So that it's not simply a formal requirement now that the court has imposed, but it has substantive meaning because these things should be addressed and resolved at sentencing.
Well, I speak only for myself, Mr. Clue, but if the matter is going back because of the forfeiture judgment, then at least for me, it makes all the sense in the world to also send that issue back and let the district judge figure out what conditions should be imposed and why.
Your Honor, in this particular case, since we're asking for other resentencing relief, I certainly would have no problem with that.
Okay, then let's take up your other issues and in whatever order you want to address them.
We've abandoned the loss issue. By letter, with agreement with the government, we'd ask the court to deem that issue abandoned and not before the court.
So you're abandoning that issue, the loss issue?
We are. Yes, okay. Your Honor. Because of the on reflection, we do feel we invited the error completely. With regard to sophisticated means objection, we don't feel that we invited the error. The government says that the defense attorney filed a PSI objection. The objection focused only on acceptance of responsibility and said if you grant our objection as acceptance of responsibility, there'll be three levels lower. Sentencing guideline range will be lowered from 108 months to 78 months at the bottom of the range, and then showed the other calculations that the PSI had imposed. We don't deem that as an invitation to commit error with regard to the other calculations. That's simply advising the court what would be the effect of granting the objection as to acceptance of responsibility. An invitation would be, and we specifically waive any objection to these other enhancements, including the sophisticated means enhancement, which was not in the plea agreement. It was not something that the parties had agreed to. They'd agreed to everything else.
But even assuming that we don't think it's invited error, then we get to plain error, right? I mean, there's no reason we wouldn't review it under the plain error standard. You would agree?
Yes.
Okay, and so why is it plain error here?
Well, it's plain error because, again, part of the problem, and this bridges
especially over. When you agreed to, didn't you agree to two levels at one point?
On the sophisticated means, there was no agreement.
All right.
The reason why it's plain error is because the government and the PSI and the court are imposing the enhancement in a sort of an automatic way for when a defendant runs his business out of an LLC. And it's really problematic. This word shell has become like toxic word in the language. You know, it's like, oh, it's a shell, that means it's bad.
I'm sorry to interrupt and I'll let you go on, but I just want to understand, because as you know, it's got to be directly contrary to statutory or guideline text, I guess, or there has to be a case that's directly on point in order for it to be considered plain error. So your theory is it's under the text of the guideline, it's a problem.
Under the commentary, at least. The commentary says that using a shell is most sophisticated if you're using it to conceal or hide assets. And in the cases even the government cites, the people that have been enhanced for sophisticated means for using a shell, which is, again, this word that's used, it just means an LLC. Everybody is not in working for the government in this room or anywhere else uses an LLC. And the reason is because that's the way you're supposed to do it. And so whether you're involved in something criminal or not involved in something criminal, 50% of the time, 100% of the time, you still use an LLC, and that's considered appropriate. So the question is, are you using it to conceal or hide assets? And there was no suggestion at all that there was anything here used to conceal or hide it. And every case in which this court has referred to the shells or LLCs as being a problem for sophisticated means, it's always inconsistent with the commentary, which says if it's being used to conceal or hide assets. And that's the error that I'm talking about, because it's important in this case, it's important in a lot of cases, that it's not an automatic thing. It's not a bad thing. It's like saying the defendant, had a stick in the course of the, yeah, he had a stick he was using it to walk with. He wasn't using it to hit somebody with. And that's to me, that is plain, because the guideline does say for that reason. The other things that the defendant did were simply turning things over, handing things over. And it's not, there's no question, no suggestion that he created any false documents, that he did anything sophisticated. He turned things over. People came to him. He turned them over to the other people. And that's our argument. We think it's plain under the commentary because of the specifics. There's one element missing. If I could turn to the other final issue, the acceptance of responsibility issue, the two components. One, the government says that it didn't breach the plea agreement because it was allowed to not recommend the acceptance of responsibility reduction if the defendant violated the law after entering the plea. But again, there was no suggestion in this case by the government or anybody else that the defendant did so. The defendant, in his objections, made it quite clear that he even in the PSI, it said it had him last using cocaine, or admitting last using cocaine at the date of his arrest. He corrected his statement, though. I last used cocaine, you know, right before the plea, like the very day before the plea, or the evening before the plea. And that accounted for these last two drug tests. And nobody said, oh, he continued thereafter to use. It was not that at all. He had the way these your analysis testing works on cocaine, it showed up twice. It showed up right then immediately that day, and it showed up a couple of days thereafter. So he did not violate the plea agreement. It was the government that violated the plea agreement. The government was required to recommend. And so when the government instead says, the probation office is right, is what they said. Now, how they characterized what the probation office is saying is disputed between the government and the defense. But they did say the probation office is right. And the probation office was wrong. The probation office said, all the probation office does is make recommendations to the court. They said, no, he used drugs. That's it. He's not recommended. It didn't say, oh, you weigh, balance it against this, balance against that. And then the district court, he didn't say, he said, oh, no. He did say as a general proposition that the district court is in the best position. That's true. But he didn't say that that meant anything other than what he actually said in terms of his ruling.
Why should we read it that way, though?
Well, there's really no other.
I mean, after all, despite your contention that the government breached because the drug use was before the execution of the plea agreement, the prosecutor did say that he had no objection if the court were to grant an acceptance of responsibility adjustment, right?
I understand. The question you're saying that the court's the question is
no, I'm
whether
saying,
that's a material breach. I think it's a material breach.
No, I'm not going to material breach.
Okay.
If the prosecutor told the court, rightfully, wrongfully, breach, not breach, I don't object if you, judge, give him an acceptance of responsibility adjustment. And then the court says, I'm in the best position to figure out whether an acceptance adjustment is warranted. Don't those things together indicate that the district court judge used his discretion to decide whether or not an acceptance adjustment was warranted?
I don't believe so, given that the sequence is when you object to the probation office report, you object to the report. The report says he used drugs while on bond. It's not recommended. The government says
that's not error.
No, that's not error because it's not a court. But it's still something that should have been this objection should have been sustained in at least in part that was an erroneous determination. The government then agrees that the probation office is correct. They misstate what the probation office said, but they agree. The district court doesn't essentially is saying, yeah, I agree as well. He's not saying, yeah, the two of you agree on this, but I'm going with the defense. He's saying, I'm following the flow of this. And then he says, because the defendant used drugs while out on bond, he violated this. And then he says,
he said that's inconsistent, right, with an acceptance of responsibility adjustment.
He violated the terms and conditions of his bond through his drug use while he was on bond. And then he says his behavior is inconsistent with that acceptance.
Exactly. The single sole factor. And again, what the guidelines require is for the court not to simply use this the way the probation office did, the way the district court did, and said, okay, this is what we put. There's a scale here. We put this on the scale. Boom, it goes down. That's it.
But the problem, Mr. Clue, is that you run into a wall of precedent here that says that the district court judge can deny an acceptance of responsibility adjustment for something like using drugs while on pretrial release.
I think that the wall of precedent, and again, I think the Pace case that they signed, every single case says the judge, if he weighs that factor against the overwhelming evidence of acceptance of responsibility. But that's not what happened here. And that's not what the PSI said. That's not what the district judge said. The district judge didn't say that. He said he violated his bond. It's inconsistent. I hear you, government. You've agreed with the probation office. The probation office says, boom, one and out, no, and that's it. And that's not what's supposed to happen. The district judge, the probation office is supposed to do it. The government's supposed to recommend it unless there was a violation, and the district court's supposed to weigh it. There were three problems here. And it's a massive amount of time. It's the whole reason you have, it's a whole import of the guidelines in relation to the criminal justice system, trial or plea decision. This is why people plead.
Counsel, what's your best case to support the proposition that the district court was required to explicitly articulate that he had weighed the drug use while on bond against other evidence?
I don't think that there's a case that says there's ever a case that's explicit requirements. I think the thrust of the court's question. However, there are cases repeatedly in this court. Let's say you look at the entirety of the record to try to determine is this the most reasonable reading of the record, or is it not the most reasonable reading of the record? The most reasonable reading of the record in this case is the district court followed the PSI, which the government said was correct, and which the only thing the district court said he evaluated. And the massive, incredible effect on this defendant suggests, particularly in the context of this case, where there's going to be a resentencing anyway, that the case should be remanded. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Clue, thank you. You've saved your time for rebuttal. Ms. Perwin.
Good morning. Please, the court. Amanda Perwin on behalf of the United States. I think that the parties generally agree on the effect of Rodriguez on this case, that the case should go back. Our position is that the remedy here is that the judgment ought to be revised to reflect that the 1988 standing order, because the judge in this case, unlike in the Rodriguez case, did impose the standard, he said, the standard conditions of release, a supervised release, in addition to the mandatory conditions. So we don't have exactly the situation that we did in Rodriguez, where there was no mention of supervised release. So the only issue, at least in our view, is that one discrepancy between the 1988 order and the judgment in this case.
But you would agree that's a problem. I mean, so I think you started out by saying you agree it needs to go back.
I agree it needs to go back and that the judgment ought to be corrected.
Well, so if the point of Rodriguez is that we want the conditions to be able to be identifiable, that is, when they're announced from the bench, we want everybody to know what's being said. It doesn't need to be said going through each one, but you have to identify, if you're going to cite to some list, you have to identify what list you're citing to. And the problem here is that the list that maybe was being cited, standard conditions, which probably was intended to line up with the standing order on standing conditions, right? Standard conditions, doesn't really match up exactly. So it makes a lot more sense, would you agree, that we just send it back and have the judge say specifically what he meant?
I think that's fine, Your Honor. We would agree to that. The next issue that I want to talk about, just briefly, I think it's pretty clear that invited error does apply with respect to the sophisticated means issue. It was not just a failure to object. In the objections to the PSR, the defendant said specifically, sentence guideline computation should be calculated as follows. And then he lists out the enhancements, and sophisticated means is in there. There are then, of course, as in most sentencings, two opportunities to object to the guidelines at sentencing. No objection to sophisticated means at either moment, only to acceptance. So I think
the first thing you mentioned about the listing of how the ultimate guideline calculation went, that was the probation office's pre-sentence investigation report?
It was in the pre-sentence investigation report, but it was also in Mr. Delgado's objections to the pre-sentence investigation report. It's one objection, of course, to acceptance, but then it's specifically, district court, you should calculate the guidelines like this, and then a list of enhancements that included sophisticated means. So under those circumstances, it is more than just a failure to object. It's inviting the district court to apply sophisticated means, among other things. But of course, even if we set that aside, there is no case, as Judge Rosenbaum, you pointed out, directly on point that would preclude the application of sophisticated means under these circumstances. This is, well, first of all, I'll start with shell companies. Using a shell company is not required. It's not the only factor the district court can consider. Here we've got a number of other factors. We've got 4 years. We've got millions of dollars. We've got fraudulent prescriptions being submitted to Medicare that are being provided by this defendant. So we've got a number of other things, even if you forget shell companies. So I don't know of any case that would foreclose the use of sophisticated means under these circumstances. And then the last issue, I think the court sort of hit it on the head with acceptance. I'll start with the breach of the plea agreement. We're not arguing really, and there's a reason why it was in a footnote, that the government was released from its plea agreement. I think Mr. Clue's point is well taken, that if the drug, you know, if he took drugs before the plea, and tested positive after, it wouldn't be fair to hold him accountable for that, or that it would release the government from its plea agreement. But the government did recommend acceptance.
Well, it didn't really recommend acceptance. It said it wouldn't object, right? It wouldn't oppose acceptance, which is different than affirmatively recommending. But even so, in the end, we have the district court saying, well, I'm going to, you know, he took, I don't think this is, his behavior is consistent with acceptance of responsibility, regardless, basically. So even if there's an error there, it may be harmless.
I agree, Your Honor. I would say I understand the difference between saying I don't object and I recommend. But I think if you look at what the prosecutor said sort of in its context, he is essentially advocating for the defendant here. He's saying, look, yes, yes, Judge, you've got the discretion. You could withhold acceptance. But this guy's got a drug problem. And he's agreeing with what the defendant said in his objections to the PSR. He does have a drug problem. I'm not going to object to acceptance of responsibility. So I understand the word choice is not a recommendation, but in its full context, it is. But Your Honor, you're correct. The district judge seemed to very well understand its discretion in this area. It said, you know, it quoted directly from the guidelines, I'm in a unique position to determine whether acceptance applies. I think this behavior is inconsistent. I'm not going to give it to him. And it's completely consistent with the case law, with the guidelines. And you know, there's a very obviously, for obvious reasons, deferential standard of review here. So I think I've covered the three issues that are still at play. If the court has no other questions.
What do you think the instruction should be with regards to forfeiture on remand?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the government has to determine in the first instance what the amount that this defendant in particular, what is forfeitable as to this defendant. And I don't know the answer to that. I don't know how much he made personally. So I think it's simply just a resentencing with respect to forfeiture.
So vacate the forfeiture judgment.
Yes, exactly.
And just send it for remand for further proceedings.
Exactly, Your Honor. Unfortunately, the record doesn't have the facts that I need to be able to say what that number might be. So I think there's got to be a hearing.
Great. Okay, Ms. Perwin, thank you very much.
Regard to the government's breach of the plea agreement, the government not only stated its position at the sentencing, it stated its position when the objections were filed. And it was announced that it did not join the defense position with regard to acceptance of responsibility, and that was reflected in the objection that was filed. Then at sentencing, the government stated that it agreed with the probation office interpretation, and then said, nevertheless, because he's a drug addict, we wouldn't object if the court decides. And the court says, well, I appreciate you saying you're not going to object, but he used while on bond, and that's behavior inconsistent with acceptance. And he quoted one of the lines from the standard for this court affords district court discretion or judgment with regard to determination. But again, the impact of it is, in my understanding of all, not readily subject to harmless error, because again, it's at two points in the process. It's not, it's when you go into sentencing with you've got the government not agreeing, then when asked whether they agree, they say they don't agree with the objection, they agree with probation, and then they don't again recommend, given that breach. While one can hypothecate that the judge would do the same thing, I believe the due process implications of the matter because it's in the plea agreement require that.
What case do you have for that? Because
I didn't see the harmless error argument in their brief, so that I didn't brief it ahead of time. I can find something.
Because I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe our case law is that if there is, when you review what the district court said, if there's any reason to believe that the district court didn't rely on what the government argued and did it based on other things, then it's harmless and we don't send it back.
The court may be right. I'd ask if I could have a couple of days to see that. I did not see the harmless error argument in their brief.
There's a case called Malone, actually, that I'm pretty sure we explored this in. Malone, M-A-L-O-N-E.
I don't know whether that's one of my Malones. Not, it could be. I can respond to it later today or within a day or something. The reason, again, that when you combine that with the fact that there is no discussion by the district court, no indication that the district court considered the sincerity of the admission of criminal responsibility, the timeliness of all the other factors, no indication that the district court considered the circumstance that the defendant had, that not just the drug problem, but he had a psychiatric problem, that this was clearly an involuntary thing, something that happened in relation to the pressure of pleading, that it's not even similar to the cases that where the acceptance was denied in this court, where you have people just they're using marijuana, they're not clearly not addicted to marijuana, or they're doing other things just well into after the plea or that sort of thing. This was really, because this case is from a factual standpoint, was so clear that the government was even though it agreed with probation, had to say, well, my gosh, this is by no means one of these guys who's out there willfully trying to violate it. The government, I think, clearly recognized that it did not diminish his acceptance. Whether it expressed those facts, it didn't. It led with the probation office, which is saying, you don't put this one thing on the scale. And so in the context of this case, where there's going to be a remand anyway, and given the tremendous impact on the judgment, it really would be the correct thing to do, given the two factors, the ambiguity of the defendant's, at a minimum, ambiguity of the district court's decision, and the other factor of the breach of the plea agreement.
All right, Mr. Clue, thank you very much. Mr. Clue, thank you very much as well.